back on downtown. It's 4:36. Time for this week's installment of Sports Lit 101 with Bruce Pratt here in studio with us. Welcome, welcome, Mr. Pratt.
Well, it's good to be here, and it's always good to learn something you don't know.
Oh, yes.
And I, as you know, I read a lot of, about hockey history of the game, the history of the leagues, in addition to my love of hockey fiction and poetry. And I did not know this story, and I'm a little surprised I didn't because of where I used to live. Anyway, December 19th in 2017, we celebrated the 100th anniversary of the first games in the NHL. Now, the NHL then consisted of four teams, the Montreal Canadiens, the Montreal Wanderers, the Toronto Hockey Club, and the Ottawa Senators. And the Montreal team shared an arena, and it burned down, and the Wanderers ended up folding, so there were only three teams, and they would play the winners of the Western Hockey League for the championship before it was Lord Stanley's Cup. So what happened on that night in 1917 was that in the first games, the Canadians beat the Senators 7-4, and the Wanderers would record their only NHL win, a 10-9 victory against Toronto. Now, the game was different then. It was different in a lot of ways. You could not pass backwards. The red line was there. You couldn't pass over two lines. There were six skaters aside, not five. There were wings, rovers, and defensemen. And so the pace of the game was different. But somebody who could really skate and could really stick handle was a tremendous advantage. Goalies couldn't drop down. They had to play standing up until a little later as the rules began to evolve and became what were known later as the Montreal rules, descended from the Halifax rules. Okay, no more of that kind of stuff, I promise. Anyway, the first game that the Wanderers played in, of their six games they would play in, there was on their team from Holyoke, Massachusetts, Jerry Geran. And I don't know whether it's G-E-R-A-N is pronounced the French way, Geran, or Geran, or something like that, because his father was said to be an Irish immigrant, which in Holyoke would make lots of sense, mm-hmm. where in on St. Patrick's Day, everything runs green in Holyoke. And also has a huge, had it at the time anyway, a very large French-Canadian population as well. And so he played, and when the season was over, he was, because the place burned down and they weren't able to continue, he went back to playing in America, where amateur hockey was a big deal. And the amateur hockey leagues, where people got paid under the table, was hardly the clean, wonderful, way of looking at amateur hockey. He played for the Boston Navy Yard team. And when he had been playing with Wanderers, he met Art Ross, who he played alongside of, who will later become the Art Ross Trophy, for the most points scored in the season. And he will later turn up in other professional hockey. But when he was young in Holyoke, he was a really good player, and he was found his way to Dartmouth. And we don't know whether he found his way there as an academic scholar or because he could really play hockey. But we do know that he was the captain of the freshman team. Of course, in those days, a freshman couldn't play. In fact, they couldn't play when I was a freshman in college on varsity teams. So he goes on to Dartmouth. He's doing well there for Dartmouth, and then all of a sudden he's considered some of a puck hog, but he's compared to Hobey Baker, who at the time is the archetype of the greatest American player. But he and two other people suddenly get suspended by Tug Taylor, the coach, and he disappears back into AAU hockey and playing on amateur hockey teams. Then he gets called to play in the Olympics, and the U.S. and Canada just tear the Europeans apart. And Canada wins the gold, America wins the silver, and he's still going along playing in these games. And then he comes back home from the Olympics and decides in the year 1921, this is where the story gets interesting, 22, to join the Club de Patineurs de Paris, which means the Skating Club of Paris. And he skated circles around the Europeans at this time. They said scoring an average of 6 goals per game. He really enjoyed his time in France, and after returning from Paris, brought with him the, quote, Paris touch, drinking wine with his meals. Now, This seems to be maybe something that comes up later on. Not that he's an alcoholic, and no one ever accuses him of living a long, healthy life, but that maybe he every once in a while like to have a drink when the coach didn't think he should. But he joined the Boston the Bay State Athletic Club, which was nicknamed the Unicorn, and he played for quite a while, and they did very, very well. And he was one of the best players going. They said he single-handedly conquered Pittsburgh, considered the best center iceman playing in American hockey today. Then something happens. There's a grocer in Boston by the name of Charles Adams who wants to get a professional hockey team. He wants to be in the NHL. He wants to be the first American franchise. And he does exactly that. And in 1924, he gets the November 1st, he gets the Bruins become the first U.S. team in the NHL. And Art Ross is at that time is a coach and general manager. He sees Jerry and he brings him in. Then he does something that is pretty interesting. He becomes the first American to score a goal in the NHL, and he becomes the first American to score two goals in the NHL. And he becomes the first American to do it in the first half, because in those days hockey wasn't divided by periods; it was divided into halves. So he stands out as the guy who's able to do that. I want to get exactly what it was said. So December 11th in Pittsburgh, having made history in 1917 as the first born player. He's now 8 years later. He now made further history, though it was not noted at the time, nor to my knowledge. This is by Roger Godin, or Godin, G-O-D-I-N, I think Godin, who wrote this for the Society of International Hockey Research. He was not noted at the time, as appeared in the Boston Globe the following, December 12, 1925. Durant played sensational hockey. He scored two goals and proved a constant threat. He deadlocked the game when he made a mad dash up the ice, filtering through the entire Pittsburgh team, shot at Werders, the goalie, the marker coming after 3 minutes of play. He duplicated the feat after 17 minutes, dribbling through the Pirates' forward line. When he reached the defenseman, split them to send the rubber speeding into the mesh. I just love sports writing of that era. Yeah. So he became the first U.S.-born player to score a goal, the first one to score two goals in one game, and the first one to... And the first one to score 2.5. A famous American once said, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here." Well, the hockey world has not noted what happened in Pittsburgh on December 11, 1925. Now, hopefully, it will. The article goes on, and I'm not going to try.
So why don't we know his name? Why is this new to us?
See, that's what I don't know. It may only be because. It may only be because those weren't the kind of records people thought about then. That you're the first American. I mean, I'm sure it appeared in a box score, but nobody pointed out and said that. But what I find interesting is there have been other articles on him, apparently. And I just joined the Society for International Hockey Research because Reg Lansbury has now convinced me this is a good thing to do. And for $30 a year, you can't beat it. I don't really know, but, you know, it's funny because there is. We were talking with Susan Panette before. His name is Jerry, G-E-R-R-Y, Duran. Now, his father is allegedly born in Ireland, and his mother is from Canada. Now, Duran, G-E-R-A-N, is not a name I have come across in the tens of thousands of pages of Irish history, Irish literature, Irish politics, and Irish culture that I've read over the years.
How do you spell his last name again?
G-E-R-A-N. Now, Guérin or Gérin could be spelled any number of ways because... the people who wrote the words down were English speakers.
Right.
And they often, and you know, my name went from Pluard to Pratt, and God knows how that happened. but, you know, in Maine, Pelkey is Pelchier, Kluki is Cloutier, because it was misheard by the people that wrote the words down. And a lot of the French people didn't, as Susan pointed out when she was here, they spoke the language, but they didn't write it because they didn't need to. So I'm really interested to see if this spurs some deeper research and, like, people looking for things. He apparently died in his 80s and was at the time a federal employee living in New York City. There were all kinds of things that he did. He was involved in building the arena in Springfield, which was the old horse barn that became the famous place of the Springfield, then known as the Indians. But they think that a lot of his, he might have been more successful, but he was way ahead of his time. He played the game differently. It was a real tic-tac-toe kind of game in the early days, and he wanted to play it more openly the way the game is played.
I'm looking him up here, and I guess this is part of the reason we don't know him, because he played that one season and then left and went to play in France for a while and came back and played 1 year with the Boston Bruins, 1925-26.
Yeah, and then he got traded to the St. Paul team, which was a minor league team. Mm. And the thing that people need to remember is that now the distinct difference between the NHL, AHL, ECHL is in the money people make. I think there's something like 400 people that have come out of the low minors, the ECHL, to play in the NHL. The day he played a really good Harvard College team, and it was Harvard College then, would be as good as the best amateur team, and the best amateur teams would be able to play against some of the best pro teams. So that the ability level wasn't the issue. It was just there weren't that many jobs in professional hockey. And so in hotbeds like Minnesota, Pittsburgh was a huge hockey town for years and years and years. A lot of people thought it would be the first NHL franchise in the U.S.
This is interesting. He stopped playing in 1933, and when he retired, he was the last player from the Wanderers still playing professional hockey.
Yeah, and the Wanderers, and that was 16 years before the Wanderers played there one season in 1917. Fascinating guy. He bird dogged him a little bit on the Olympics. He said, "Well, they didn't know if he could go in 1924. He might have business things to do." And he was playing for another team, and then suddenly, yep, he shows up. He's on the boat. He's getting ready to go. He apparently really loved being in France, and anytime he could get to Europe, he would try to get to France, which is also funny because there's never many mention of him going to visit his father's homeland of Ireland, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at least that I know. I only had from yesterday afternoon to read this, go through this, and then try and look up some other stuff, so I may find some more things. But if he was carrying his mother's name, last name, for any particular reason, he did seem to really be, he was quite a Francophile.
There's also an article about him in the December 2021 edition of the Hockey Research Journal, entitled "The Mysterious Jerry Garand."
Yeah, and that's what this one is. This is from 2021, the mysterious Jerry Garand.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
So what? Well, but there was one earlier, and it's cited in the bibliography here, the works cited page, that there was another mention of him in an early one. Now, the guy that wrote this is the team curator for the Minnesota Wild, the author of several books and articles, and former vice president of Sierra. He's written on baseball and hockey. I've read stuff by him before, but I just love finding out about these guys in history that we should know about.
Absolutely.
That we don't know about.
Well, that's fascinating.
He's one of them.
That's great. Thank you, Bruce.
My pleasure.
It was fun. What's next week?
Next week, I think what we're going to do is classic sports poetry.
Oh,
I'm
love
thinking
it.
Of A.E. Hausman's To an Athlete Dying Young and Casey at the Bat. And we'll look at some of those things.
It's a good time of year for that.
Well, that's what I thought. It's a transitional time of the year. I'm trying to find one. I'll get a great hockey poem from John B. Lee or Al Purdy or somebody. We'll try and get one from as many sports as we can.
Sounds great. Sports Lit 101 every Wednesday right here on